on the old Kent Road, where yours truly had been apprenticed. I should abandon the cab and secrete myself amidst the thick gorse that enveloped the memorial stones. If my would-be assassin came back this way, I could pick him off from my hiding place among the angels. These thoughts were flashing across my mind when suddenly the mist thinned, and I saw the enormous outline of a grand building only a matter of 50 yards ahead. It was a bleak-looking chapel of some kind, its towers sparkling eerily, its great black door securely barred against all comers, and I was heading straight for it. Wrenching the reins until I felt the hot leather tearing at my palms, I tried to steer the carriage away from the chapel. The horse gave a great snorting cry and lurched right. I reeled from the impact as the side of the cab slammed against the old wooden doors of the building. There was a tremendous booming crash, and I felt the whole cab splinter and the ground hurtle up towards me. My chest hit the iron-hard mud, and I felt the wind comprehensively knocked from me. Dazed and sick, I lay on my front, staring miserably ahead as the pursuing cab drew up alongside the chapel. The figure, swathed in ulster, scarf and brown bowler, seemed smaller now as he clambered down from the driver's seat. In one gloved hand he held a pistol. I tried to roll over, but the breath was only coming back to me with agonizing slowness. Just ahead and out of reach lay my own pistol, the long barrel protruding from a clump of weeds. I flung out my arm and tried to drag myself towards it. The figure advanced remorselessly, cocking his weapon and reaching up with his other hand to pull down the scarf from his face. Was it that vengeful fury pug? There was a hole the size of a tanner in the shoulder of his cape, but no sign of blood. Had I winged him or merely ruined his coat? Lungs bursting, I tried to sit up and sling myself into cover. "Damn it," I gasped. "Who are you, you ruddy maniac?" The figure stopped and seemed to consider me. Then, echoing across the cemetery with the eeriness of a banshee, came a cry. "Hello? What's going on? What are you doing here?" Two men holding yellow lamps high above their heads hove into view to my left. Their appearance had a startling effect on my attacker. Swiftly he slipped his pistol into the folds of his ulster and raced back towards the cab, pulling himself up into the driver's perch. He whipped up the horse and rattled away. Ran towards me as welcome as real angels. "Good Lord, are you all right, sir?" said one. His companion, heavily bearded and mean-looking, was less forgiving. "What a blazes has been going on?" he demanded. Ignoring him, I struggled to my feet and grabbed for my pistol. I aimed at the retreating cab, but in moments it was out of range. I turned on my heel and wrenched the lamp from the bearded man's hand. "Here, what you doing?" "His number," I hissed. "The cab number. Can you see it?" Nothing was clear, though, in the sickly yellow light, and the cab soon vanished into the murk. I stood for a moment, swinging the lamp round in an arc and illuminating the devastation I had wrought. My cab was almost cracked in two. The horse stood nearby, placidly chewing grass at the foot of one of those broken columns that tell of a life cut off in its prime. Happily, that life had not been mine.
"Here," cried the bearded rescuer, "you was bloomin' shooting. What the hell do you think you're about? This is a place of rest."
The cemetery watchman took me to a little cabin where I was treated to a tot of rum by the kinder of the two, Lukey by name, and furious glares from his mate, name of Bob. I assured the good burghers that all expenses would be met. In the morning, I would dispatch the domestics to set about hushing things up, not least the body of the faithful Delilah, who was probably still lying undiscovered with a bullet between her shoulder blades on some dreadful suburban roadway. I dragged my ragged, filthy, and exhausted self to my feet and was moving towards the cabin door when a notice pinned to the wall caught my gaze. "What is that?" I asked. "That's the interments list, sir," said Lukey. "It is, by George, and that name, fourth down. The Verdigris Mausoleum, sir." "What a coincidence," I mused. "An acquaintance of mine goes by that name. I wonder if it's his family tomb. Would it be an awful imposition to ask me to see that mausoleum?" The bearded one positively glared at me and cleared his throat of a noisome expectoration that landed in a hissing green lump on the coals of the fire. "The Verdigris, indeed it would. After what you've been up to tonight, you're damn lucky we ain't called the Bobbies." Lukey laid a hand on the other's arm. "Now then, Bob, watch that temper of yours. You said there was something funny about that funeral in any case." I adopted a sombre expression. "Gentlemen, I am investigating certain irregularities connected with that funeral. It is more than likely that you have given invaluable service to the Crown. I need you to show me that mausoleum at once."
Woo!
With much ill grace, Bob finally assented, and a few minutes later, the three of us stepped back out into the humid night. Our feet crunched on the gravel pathways, the lantern held aloft by Bob, throwing a funnel of yellow light into the oily gloom. I was dog-tired but pressed on, unsure of what, if anything, I might find. The Verdigris family tomb was about the size of a small cottage, done in the familiarly dreary style of Corinthian columns and arched roof. A pair of massive bronze doors were set in the centre, a thick, well-oiled padlock strung between the door handles like a fob chain across the waistcoat of a prize fighter. "There," barked Bob the lantern carrier, "can we now get back to our business?" I moved towards the mausoleum and craned my neck to make out the family name, picked out in black against the white marble. I assumed the masterful tone that comes so easily to me. "Quickly, man, the key!" "Now hold on a moment. Give him the key, Bob," wailed Lukey. Cursing, the burly fellow began to fiddle with the huge bunch of keys at his waist. "Hurry," I urged. At last he selected a long, spindly specimen, and grunting with the effort, shifted his belly forward so he could insert it into the lock. As soon as the tumblers clicked, I dragged at the chain and hauled it to the ground. "The lantern, Bob," I hissed. "Give it to me." So saying, I grabbed the thing from his hand and, dragging open the doors, plunged into the mausoleum. Inside, the air was suffocatingly stale. The grim black oblong of a new coffin stood out boldly on its shelf against the homogeneous dust-grey boxes that abutted it. "Give me a hand," I commanded, pulling at the head end of the coffin. "Here," cried Bob, entering the building. "No time to explain," I cried shrilly. "Get the coffin on the floor and get the lid off." "Do as he says," said Lukey. "He's on to something." Together, Lukey and myself pulled the coffin to the dust-thick floor. Then I began to look about for something to prise open the lid. "My God, if the family find out about this," murmured Bob. "Never mind that," I barked. "Hold the lantern high." I swung round and then stopped as my eyes alighted on half a dozen wooden chairs, stacked in the corner and presumably for use at funerals. Without hesitation, I grabbed the top chair and smashed it to pieces on the floor. From the debris, I retrieved a chair leg, and with this began to hammer away under the coffin lid. After 10 or 12 blows, the lid gave with a nasty squeal and splintered across. "Pull it apart," I cried. "Open the thing." Lukey stepped forward and, grasping at the wood, wrenched the lid away. Bob glided forward from out of the shadows, the queasy yellow lantern light flooding the macabre sight before us. "Well, bless my soul," whispered Lukey, for within the coffin was revealed a cloth dummy, its innards stuffed with straw, its eyes and mouth merely crude stitching like that on some common scarecrow. Thank you. In the distance, a clock struck four. I stirred and found myself lying prone on cold stone. Shifting a little, I cracked open stinging eyes, peered blearily about, coughed and opened my mothball stale mouth. I tried to sit up, but sank back at once onto the chilly floor, skull throbbing as though it were fixed about with a tight iron band. Where the hell was I? I raised my head again, widening my eyes in a last-ditch attempt at wakefulness. I was in some kind of cell, windowless and cramped. Slimy straw lay all about me, and there was a pervasive odour of ammonia. Head splitting, I somehow managed to stumble to my feet and then sank back against the wet bricks. Looking down at myself, I saw that I was in full evening dress, my shirt front torn and the lapels of my coat plastered with mud. I could recall nothing at all. Never mind where was I, who was I? I hammered my fist against my forehead and screwed up my eyes. Something about a box with a centipede in it. No, that wasn't right. Perhaps it was a book in a box. Daniel Licorice. Was that my name? No. A jack in a box. Jackbox. Jackpot? That was something else entirely, I felt sure. My name is Box. Ah, Lucifer Box. Yes, yes. I placed the flat of my hands against the chilly wall and willed myself to remain calm. Lucifer Box of Downing Street, London. I shook my head over and over. I must concentrate. Where was I? Italy. Italy, of course. Naples. But why? Why? I snapped open my eyes and struggled to focus on the cell door. It looked depressingly solid. Bending down, I peered through the rusted keyhole. I could just make out a suggestion of a gloomy corridor beyond. I sank down against the wall, then leant forward as I became aware of something poking into my back. I had a dim remembrance of a similar feeling connected to a yellow villa in Islington, but this was not quite the same. Exploring under the tail of my ruined shirt, my fingers closed upon the warm, reassuring presence of my revolver, still strapped in the hollow above my buttocks, that nature had almost seemed to have provided for the express purpose. I took it out, opened the chamber, and span it. "That won't help you," came a whispered voice from the darkness. I started and whirled around, brandishing the pistol. Nothing. "Who's there?" I demanded. A hissing chuckle sounded close by. I crept towards the far wall. Just about visible was a tiny barred window, evidently connecting to the cell next door. I pressed my face to it, making out a crouched figure in the gloom beyond. He turned his face toward me, but little detail was visible in the filthy mass of hair and beard. "Oh," I cried. "Hello." "Good evening. Or is it morning? I no longer know. My name is Box, and mine's the Count of Monte Cristo." I pulled back from the window slightly, alarmed at the fellow's crazed laughter. He fixed me with a wild eye and shuffled across the floor of his cell. "As I say, that weapon of yours won't do you any good. They don't feel pain. They don't feel anything."
"Who don't?"
"They came for me, you see. I was getting too close to the truth. Mr. Poop, he was onto them."
My ears pricked up. "Poop? What do you know of Poop?" The strange old man coughed noisily.
"Looting they was, stripping the excavations bare and flogging the stuff to keep this wretched place going."
"Excavations?
They've forgotten me now." "Thrown away the key. Maybe you'll rot here too."
As if in response, a key rattled in the lock and my door was thrown open. A strange figure was framed there, very tall, clad in black, and wearing what appeared to be some kind of brass helmet. I rubbed at my eyes. Was this still part of my strange purple dream?
had the notion of a lead-shoed diver sprung to life before me. My neighbour in the next cell jumped to his feet and pressed his grimy face to the bars. "Look out, they've come for you. Don't resist. They don't feel anything." The extraordinary helmeted figure stumped across the cell towards me and opened his great arms as though offering an embrace. I thrust the revolver into my pocket and backed away. Pale as death, the man's jaw hung slackly open, a strand of drool dangling from his lips. His eyes, staring blankly ahead, were a horrible yellow-grey, like the yolks of overboiled eggs. My gaze was drawn, however, to the strange brass thing that covered the top part of his face. On the closer inspection I was now afforded, I could see it was like a Norman helmet, though the upper part was made of glass and glowing a weird sickly purple. Great brass screws were inset at the temples, effectively clamping the helmet to his head. Stepping quickly to one side, I raced towards the door, bargaining that the brute's sluggish gait would count against him. "No good," croaked my neighbour through the barred window. "He'll get you." At once the creature changed direction and cut me off, his eyes rolling in his head, arms outstretched in deadly intent. I resorted to my pistol, but he swung at me, knocking the weapon flying. As I moved to retrieve it, his sweaty hands jerked forward and clamped about my throat. I staggered backwards, gasping at the terrible pressure. cried my neighbour. "Now you're done for." White face was right by mine, and I could see directly into the glass section of his strange headgear. Inside seemed to float a purplish miasma. I dug my nails into the flesh of his throttling hands, but he did not even react, forcing me backwards as I beat and pounded at his face. My head felt as though it would explode at any second. Desperately, I thrust my thumbs into his eyes and pushed with all my strength. The soft flesh gave sickeningly, but still I pressed on, digging into the very sockets and forcing my thumbs upwards. No scream did he make, nor sign that he felt even a scintilla of pain. "Told you so, told you so. They feel nothing. The devils," cackled my fellow prisoner. I hammered my fist against my attacker's chest, but his great weight forced me to my knees. I groped wildly about in the straw. "The revolver!" Rolling us both over with a supreme effort, I grasped at the pearl handle of the gun, aimed desperately, and loosed off a bullet into the brute's chest. He was knocked back as though plucked by a giant hand, staggered and slumped against the wall. I groped at my throat and rubbed my crushed windpipe, struggling to draw ragged, whooping breaths. Suddenly, the helmeted monster was on his feet again, seemingly oblivious to the wound in his chest. He surged forward, his great hands flexing, intent on rejoining battle at once. Though dazed and exhausted, I scrabbled to my feet and made a dash for the door. The fellow threw himself forward and grabbed at my ankles, succeeding in getting both hands around one of them and bringing me down on the floor. I swiveled on my rump and planted my boot in the middle of his face, kicking savagely until I felt his nose crack and bright blood fountain onto my trouser leg. I tried to take aim again, but the lumbering giant gripped my other ankle and shook me about like a rag doll. The pistol went off, but was sent clattering against the wall. With a cry, I shuffled forward and managed to get my fingers under the edge of the helmet. I tugged violently, desperately. Swarming forward with one last effort and gripping the helmet for dear life, I kicked the fellow in the throat, sending him vaulting backwards. I was left clutching the brass helmet in both hands. And now he began to scream. A dreadful, tortured gurgle it was as his suddenly bare head was exposed to the world. There were huge gory gouges in his temples where the attaching screws had been ripped out, and he raised his hands to them, gasping in pain and shock. "Lor, you done it for him. How did you manage that?" hissed my hairy cellmate in amazement. I glanced down at the helmet. The strange gaseous substance still swirled within the glass enclosure, but I could now see that thin, delicate pipes led from it into the screws that had been affixed to my attacker's temples. A tarry liquid began to leak from inside, and its dark mauve colour was at once familiar. And then I remembered. I felt my overtaxed brain making connections like points charging on a railway. It was the same stuff that had nearly done for me and Charlie. Charlie, of course! The boy had been on the point of telling me something of vital import when... I looked down at the strange helmet again. Piped directly into its poor owner's bloodstream, the mauve stuff had rendered him little more than a zombie. Putting the helmet carefully aside, I scrabbled for my revolver and levelled it at the prone figure. The man had begun to weep from his gory eyes, great heavy tears mixing with the drool and blood plastered over his dead white face. He tried to raise himself up on one hand, but sank back to the floor with a great cry. I suddenly realised there wasn't much time. Scuttling across to him on my knees, I managed to raise the fellow's head up, cradling it in the crook of my arm. It was like the death of Bloody Nelson. "Tell me," I whispered, "who did this to you?" The mauve fluid was trickling out of the wounds in his temples. Great rasping gulps began to sound from the fellow's blood-caked mouth, and then with a dreadful rattling gurgle, he pitched back into my arms quite dead. I got to my feet. The fellow had been sent to collect me or to kill me. Either way, it was wise to get moving. "Wait, wait!" cried my neighbour. "What about me?" I paused on the threshold. "You're no use to me in this babbling state." I slipped through the open door and out into the darkened corridor. As I passed the adjacent cell, the old fellow thrust towards me desperately. "Please, I'll tell you. Just let me out." I took a chance and shot the lock off. He raced out into the corridor, but I covered him warily. He seemed just the type to leap for my throat. "All right," I muttered, backing away from the stink he gave off. "Where are we?" He pushed his long grey hair from his eyes. "Why, the Vesuvius Club, of course." "Still? Good. That's good. Now tell me more about poop and those looted treasures." I gestured with the pistol and we began to creep off the corridor, keeping our voices low. "I knew Mr. Poop. Did a lot of work for him. I know my way about this city, you see."
"You're an informant?"
The old man cackled. "Oh, keeps my ear to the ground."
"Go on."
"Well, Signor Poop was onto some sort of racket in stolen stuff. Old statues, that sort of thing, hocked off to the best Chelsea drawing rooms and Nobs offices. He reckoned that's how Venus's fella got that V Club up and running. They were smuggling stuff out of Naples in coffins, pretending it was bodies, then smuggling the moolah back in. We was getting close to nabbing them when... Well,
I nodded slowly. "You got your ear a little close to the ground, eh?"
This must be the fellow Charlie had mentioned. I scratched my chin. Where was Charlie now? It was vital that I find him and pump him, for information, you understand. We emerged suddenly into a curtained area, and there, sitting on a stool with his back towards us, was the curious ape-like chap who had greeted me when I first arrived. I gestured to my bearded friend that he should make for the front door and Scarpa. He nodded and gave me a little bow. Then I cleared my throat noisily and the monkey man turned on his stool. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Poop's informant steal towards the exit and silently slip through it to freedom. My head still ached appallingly from the mauve gas, but I thrust my hands into my trouser pockets and looked about with a casual air. "Hello again. Got a little lost in all these damned corridors. Had a little adventure, but found my way back. Not to worry." I strode off down the long corridor. When finally I stood once more before the great doors, I paused to make myself presentable. Magnified by the gasping gas jets, my shadow leapt hugely over the walls. Once again, the sweet sounds of debauchery bled from under them. Raising my fist, I hammered twice on the black surface. Almost immediately, the doors rasped open, and a flickering red light washed over me. I stepped inside, but felt my way barred at once by a great bear-like shape. Membership was clearly an exclusive affair. Charlie, of course, had previously gained this ingress, and I suddenly realised that it might be a little more difficult alone. "Yes," came a thick voice from the dimness. I was damned if I was going to say, "May I come in, please?" So instead I ordered, "Stand aside," with all the boldness I could muster. There was movement in the darkness, which I realised must be the fellow shaking his fat head. "Can't do that, sir. You have to give the signal." I nodded and shrugged, as though cursing my own stupidity. "The signal? Of course." I rubbed my hands together and laughed lightly. "What signal?" The impressive shape shifted on its feet. I patted my pockets as though the solution might be found in there. Why hadn't I observed more closely when Charlie had stood in this position? Had he given a password of some kind? No, the doorman would have said so. It was a signal he was after. The shape began to move towards me with some menace. I knew I would be put out on the wrong side of the door within seconds. A signal. Something to do with the Vesuvius Club. Something simple and recognisable. Then a notion popped into my head. I took a chance and thrust my fingers up before his nose in a V-shape. He stopped his inexorable progress. I curved my hand and formed a C that I slapped against my palm as I had seen Charlie do. The creature stepped aside. "Have a very good evening, sir," he growled. "Thank you. I intend to." I breathed with relief, moving swiftly past him and into the heaving chamber beyond. The room was still what you might call a pornucopia. My ragged appearance excited no comment, and I proceeded to a couch occupied solely by a mournful-looking youth with terrible acne. I sat down as far from him as possible and stuck out my long legs before me. He began at once to cast shy glances at my loveliness, but I studiously ignored him, content instead to watch the activities of two splendidly naked ladies who were cavorting on the floor with their bums in the air. A rough-looking waiter sauntered past with a tray of drinks, and I grabbed him by his skinny wrist. He thrust a shot glass into my hand and moved off into the crowd. I turned back and discovered I was still under the scrutiny of the grisly youth perched at the other end of the sofa. I raised my glass and toasted him. His cheeks, angry with blemishes, burned redder still. "I am Ricardo," he mumbled. "And I'm..." I threw him a pitying look. "I'm afraid you're terribly ugly." His whole frame sank with shame. "Buonasera, Venus."
Thank you.
returned the cry. It had come from a thick-set fellow far to my left who was wiping beer from the wet stalactites of his moustache. Venus. She had fetched up more respectably this time, in a dress of dazzling crimson, one hand on her shapely hip, in the approved style, the other clutching a long amber cigarette holder. She was exchanging gossip and laughter with her clientele, her coal-rimmed eyes shining with mirth. Charlie had said she was the paramour of the villain who owned this place. Had she been complicit in lighting the lamp with its strange mauve poison, or was she merely an unwilling pawn? Either way, I had to hide. Without a second thought, I reached across the sofa, grabbed the spotty young thing by his tweedy lapels, and pulled him to me. On the other hand, I said, moving him around to screen me, I've always had a penchant for ugly boys. Master Ricardo set to with a vengeance, his pinkish lips slapping against my mouth in a squid-like action that was most disagreeable. To my astonishment, an albino in a beret then toddled towards us, as though the kiss had been some general call to arms. He began fiddling with my fly button as my eyes goggled above the pitted curve of Acne Boy's cheek. As soon as Venus had moved away, I repelled all borders with a disgusted cry, pushing young Ricardo to the filthy floor and kicking the albino in the solar plexus. He flopped like a bag of wet washing, and I stooped at once as though to help him, all the time keeping an eye on Venus as she made a halting progress through the chamber, wreathed in the bluish smoke of her cheroot. At the end of the long mirrored bar was a door inset with a frosted pane. Venus glided towards the door, and then glancing swiftly around, passed through into the darkness beyond. I rolled the albino into a corner and then swiftly followed Venus, threading through knotted limbs conjoined in shameless excess. Turning the handle, I opened the door and slipped silently through. The sudden quiet startled me. Torches sputtered in gold stanchions, revealing the curve of a broad corridor disappearing into gloom. I smiled to myself now. This really was a secret tunnel. I could hear the tap to Venus's elegant heels on the stone floor ahead. Pulling off my boots as quietly as I could and clutching them to my chest, I followed her. Padding along, I kept myself snug to the wall until I came to a branch in the tunnel. It continued to my left. To my right, I could make out the top of a spiral stairwell. Only the first three of the worn stone steps were visible as they descended into darkness. Unsure as to which route Venus had taken, my attention was momentarily caught by a heavy tapestry that was fixed to the brickwork. In the flickering torchlight, its threads leapt out in golds, reds, and purples. It was clearly very old and seemed to show the broad sweep of a harbour dominated by the great hulk of a black mountain. I moved closer. The weave was disintegrating, but I could just make out that a pillar of smoke was escaping from the embroidered summit. Vesuvius. High-waisted modernists, with me, DJ Gigi, the blue-haired hippie. Check out the archives at wfmu.org/playlists/HW.
18 and 80. Those under 18 can't understand it. Those over 80 can't stand it. Hurry, hurry, the show's just starting.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to Newfoundland on Sheena's Jungle Room, part of WFMU Freeform Radio. Today, another No Male Vocals themed show. No real theme besides that. Some fun, funky, fabulous women from around the world. This month is WFMU's Hellraiser. That's a fundraiser that's held during October. And if you like WFMU, if you like my show or any of the shows you listen to, I encourage you to donate. Cancel your Spotify subscription, as I did, and share the wealth with a chaotic volunteer-run station that has more original programming. So much original programming, I have to barf sometimes just thinking about it, but we could really use your donation, and the link is at the top of my page if you're using the web player, and it will help us get through these winter months and continue to bring you the best in original programming and resist the tides of streaming gentrification. So, if that sounds good, donate. Anyways, I'm here all hours, so talk to you soon.
Once I turned you on, and you were on all day and most of the night, but no more. No, no, radio, radio, radio. Stinks. I mean, stinks.
I'm dancing in the middle, looking up. I'll see my future, ugly monsters eating each other. Looking down, I'll see my past, newborn babies washed down by the sea.